Hearts and Shadow House. Again, that's the Hollow Sidewalks record release show Wednesday, January 18th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Hollow Scene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 10:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland and kboo.fm on the web. We thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. You're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate, where we're streaming live. Next up, it's the Food Show, today bringing you Hunger Myths, Meat Addiction, and a Portland Woman's Vodka Brand. And before we get to that, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And also by the Skyline Tavern Project, a not-for-profit historic saloon at the edge of Forest Park, dedicated to supporting art and ecology through live music, food, and horseshoes, 8031 Northwest Skyline Boulevard, or at skytav.com. Here comes the Food Show.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Later on in the show, we'll have our regular segment with Marisha Auerbach, where we talk about what you can do in your home vegetable garden. After that, we'll hear from an interview with Chauncey King, owner of Royalty Spirits in Portland. Chauncey is a Black woman running a business in a male-dominated industry and embraces a dare-to-be-brave approach to success. At the end of the show, we'll have a live interview with Marta Zaraska, author of the book Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. We'll be talking about the sociology and history of meat that both vegetarians and meat eaters alike will find provocative. But first, almost 40 years ago, the book World Hunger, 12 Myths became an instant classic. It has been a valuable tool throughout the years to address the truth about hunger and what it really takes to end it. The world has changed a lot over the past 40 years, but hunger still exists. Francis Moore LePay and Joseph Collins, the authors of World Hunger, decided it was time to update the book. They just released World Hunger 10 Myths, which takes into account recent history and advances in technology. I was fortunate enough to talk with Francis Moore LePay about the book and the obstacles facing the elimination of hunger worldwide. This is a basic but pretty essential question since we're talking about World Hunger 10 Myths. How do you define hunger?
Well, that is not a simple question, because for way too long, the official agency of the United Nations that measures hunger for us has defined it in terms of calorie deficiency. And that may have made sense when we were eating diverse diets that contained all the nutrients we need, but we live in a world where actually calories and nutrition are parting ways. So I, in this book with Joseph Collins, my co-author, we really broke with the standard calorie definition of hunger. That comes to the most recent count, about 800 million people in the world, or 1 in 9 people. But if you look at other measures, such as from the World Health Organization and others looking at our nutritional well-being, it's a different story. And roughly a quarter of us are nutritionally deprived, we put it that way. We can measure that in the stunting of young children. We can measure it in the WHO's estimate that 2 billion of us are lacking an essential nutrient. and at least one, and that is no small matter, as, for example, deficiency in iron is connected to one out of every five maternal deaths. So we really broke with the standard definition here, and we really think that the world needs to focus on nutritional deprivation, not simply calorie deficiency.
How does the inaccuracy of defining hunger, how does that actually lead to the problem?
Well, we're just not measuring the right things. I mean, let me just give you an example. I spoke with a doctor in southern India, in Andhra Pradesh, who has for decades been treating. He has a clinic there, and he treats a couple thousand patients every month. And he said that, yes, in the past, people were deficient in calories. And the question was, you know, how do we supply more? And in this case, the government of India has a public distribution program of subsidized white rice. Well, he told me that now what has happened is, yes, there's enough calories, but white rice is almost vacant in nutrients. And so people can get enough calories, but he said that something like 60% of his patients suffer from diabetes and or heart conditions because they're not getting enough nutrients. So it's absolutely foundational that we can't address hunger unless we define it properly. And in other words, if we're just, in this case, making sure people get access to white rice, but it doesn't sustain them, then that's not a solution. And the solution is biodiverse farming, and this is why we're so excited in this book to share all that is growing, knowledge and plants about how we can grow diverse crops. And I tell stories about my meeting Indians not too far from where this doctor is, actually, who are growing, you know, 20 crops in one field that I walked in, one very small field of 1 or 2 acres.
Well, and I want to get into the role of organic agriculture and biodiverse, you know, crops. But to kind of take it back, you describe the root causes of hunger not as scarcity of food, but as scarcity of democracy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean democracy is a shorthand for the distribution of power in a society. Democracy is my shorthand word for all of us having a voice in social decision-making that determines whether or not we have access to land and jobs and therefore food. So it's just a shorthand way of saying that we, for example, in the United States today, we rank 56th in the world in terms of infant mortality, right? Below, right in there with Lithuania. And yet we have plenty of food in the United States, and we are the leading exporter, right? So that infant death is one way of getting a handle on nutritional deprivation, people not getting the nutrients they need, and poverty. And so what I'm saying is that lack, that measure of terrible suffering, of loss of babies, that is from a lack of democracy, meaning that the people who are suffering in that way don't have a voice in our society because, as increasingly we're aware, because of the power of private wealth that has infused itself into our electoral system. So we are suffering, as so many people in the world are, with a deficit in democracy that shows up, in our case, in babies dying, prematurely or unnecessarily, and overall, 1 in 6 of us are suffering from food insecurity. It's called, you know, not knowing for sure if we're going to be able to feed ourselves. So this is not the result of lack of food. This is the result of lack of power, which is a sign that democracy has been rigged.
So then are there places where democracy is abundant? Are they not experiencing as much hunger?
Yeah, I mean, there is no, let me just be clear, you know, there is no ideal democracy in the world, but there are ways, and this is really my life's theme song, is looking at where do we see, whether it's the village level or the national level or the international level, where do we see people gaining voice and power being distributed and setting the rules so that it is fluid and stays distributed. And so I tell the story in the book about a city that my daughter Anna LaPay and I visited some years ago in Brazil. Now, Brazil is going through very hard times right now, However, it has shown the way toward a kind of municipal democracy. And what I mean by this is that they had a very high rate of child mortality and other signs of hunger. And the city government in the 90s ran on, the mayor ran on the platform of, I'm going to address the roots of hunger in this city. You know, even if you're poor, I'm still your mayor and I'm going to get at this. And that administration put in place a citizens' council that really involved all sectors of society, and they came up with a whole range of creative but sort of obvious innovations in the market system to keep the market honest and available to everyone. It's not getting rid of the market. It's making it so that we can all participate in the market. That's my redefinition of a free market, is the freedom to participate in it. And so just to give you one example, they created local, really little farm spots in the city where farmers, all, many of them organic, can sell their great nutritious food right there with, you know, great locations, so they have plenty of customers, but they have to keep the prices within the reach of the inner city population. And I could go on and on, you know, string of dozens of examples of this kind of innovation. And you know what they achieved? In 12 years, they cut the child death rate by 73%. That is almost, I think, historic in terms of the speed of social change, right? So I'm saying that kind of gaining a voice, they also have what's called participatory democracy, participatory budgeting in the city that I'm referring to. The name of it is Belo Horizonte, and it's a city of almost 3 million people in Brazil. And so we have stories like this. This is not, you know, the social equivalent of rocket science. It's very, you know, it's very common sense of people gaining voice and making these very, in a way, simple emendations on the market.
Well, that speaks to the myth that power is too concentrated, that it's too late to actually make changes. It sounds like in this place, in Brazil, they decided to make it a priority. And as a result, they were able to make, it sounds like, relatively rapid changes.
Very rapid, yeah.
Well, I want to talk about how this book has evolved because, I mean, originally there were 12 myths, right? World hunger, 40 years ago. It came out 40 years ago. It was a different world. What you're describing is kind of like the result of a more sort of global civilization where we can take things from other places to improve. But I'm imagining in that same time, there have been many things globally that have caused more problems. So how has this book evolved over the past 40 years?
Well, we know so much more about the problem and so much more about the solutions, is one way of saying it. For example, there are two chapters, maybe my favorite ones. One, we take on, okay, what do we know about the dominant model, what is now called industrial agriculture, that, you know, we're told that's the only way to feed the world. What do we know about the real limits of it and how it is an absolute dead end? It's not just that it's a little bit environmentally problematic. It is a dead end, and I can tell you what I mean by that. On the other hand, what we know, so we know it's a lot worse than we thought, and it's implicated in climate change. Something like 29% of our greenhouse gas emissions are, you know, contributed by our food system. So it's a problem. And the next chapter following that one is about what we do know now about agroecology, how much more science there is than there was 40 years ago about how we can be more creative with the traditional insights of how to create agriculture in which we are working with nature. We are enabling and encouraging the natural regenerative power of nature and learning how to work with various plant and insect species so that we don't have to use deadly chemicals that harm the environment in order to resist pest infestations. And it's both that things have gotten much worse in some ways, and yet we know so much more and have so many more examples, such as the one from Brazil and the spread of the right to food in the world is a constitutional right now in almost 30 countries. So we know, and so much more. We're so much more enlightened about what's necessary. And yet, on so many levels, things are so much worse in terms of the environmental destruction and what I called nutritional deprivation. And people being able to get calories, perhaps, in most cases, but not the nutrients they need. I've been following, and I bet you haven't heard this, and I bet your listeners haven't, but the African country of Niger, which had experienced a great desertification and the Sahara, you know, Sahara Desert sort of moving south and people having to move out because it was just not growing the food they needed. Well, about 20 years ago, they meaning the small farmers, working with a couple of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, but mainly farmer-led, indigenously-led, started developing what they call farmer-managed natural regeneration of forests. And over 20 years, they have re-nurtured. This is by not planting trees, which is often very difficult to get them going in harsh climates, but by finding the old roots and stumps of trees and then nurturing their regrowth. Now the forests are covering half of the farmland in Niger combined with crops, and in many cases yield double when you combine these regrowing trees, these new forests, with crops. And what happens is then you also have the fruits of the trees. You have the roots of the trees that hold the soil in when the wind blows. You have the leaves of the trees that cool the soil down so that not so much water evaporates. And they're saying that underground springs are returning to the area. And food security for about more than 2.5 million people has been secured through this farmer-led restoration of forests. This is success story unlike any in Africa, and we just got to get this sort of example out there so that people can see that we don't have to resort to industrial methods which are so destructive of our planet and the climate.
And I just recently on the Food Show reported about an article, and sort of the statement of the article was that in a world with experiencing climate change, that organic agriculture is actually more adaptable, more able to address the issues of climate change. And you talk about climate change in the book. So what's the impact of climate change on world hunger?
Well, I think of small organic farmers as being our climate heroes. I think we should be celebrating them and including them in discussion. You rarely hear about the role of agriculture when these climate debates occur. But in fact, it is organic agriculture that stores more carbon in the soil and emits much fewer, as little as 1/3 per acre of emissions can be attributed to these methods, the positive methods, agriculturally, ecological methods, than industrial agriculture. So it's a win-win for both. It stores more, and certainly this agroforestry that I just described, I didn't use that word, but that's what I was describing in Niger, the combining of the reforestation and cropping. That is shown by many sources. Even the World Bank agrees that that is one of the most important ways to store carbon, that it has a tremendous potential. One study we cite in the book is a scientist estimates that if the EU converted to organic practices in agroforestry, that it could sequester about 37% of all greenhouse gas emissions from the EU as of 2007. That's when the study was done. So this is an absolute win-win for us all. It's so central to the solution.
Another myth you address, I feel like, is sort of the elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. So, and it seems like an obvious conclusion that the more people there are in the world, the more difficult it is to feed everybody. Yet you argue that that's not the case. What is the role of population growth in hunger?
Well, Joe Collins and I, ever since we started working together back in the 70s, have, you know, we always get that answer, that question. And when you said elephant in the room, I knew what you were going to say. Because that seems so intuitively obvious that if we just had fewer people, that that would be a key part of the solution. Well, there are many problems with that assumption. One, of course, is that the obvious that there is no scarcity of food now relative to population, that we produce about 2,900 calories for every person on Earth every day. That's more than enough. So there's that. But the way Joe and I like to express it, and we do in this book, World Hunger 10 Myths, is that hunger and rapid population growth are actually symptoms of the same cause. So if we want to address both population and hunger, we have to make the same changes, which is the empowerment of people, especially women. And so we talk in this book about what is the process through which women gain empowerment and how that's associated with lowered birth rates, and also point out just that actually almost half the world's people live in countries where fertility rates are below replacement level today, and that most of the continuing population growth is in, you know, a relatively confined. I mean, it's not everywhere. More than half of all remaining growth in population is occurring in just 7 countries plus 9 states in India. Together, they represent 1/5 of the world's population. So it's very clear where that population growth is happening, primarily in Africa, for example. It's where people are disempowered and their families, they don't have access to contraception in part. Women don't have control over their own bodies, and they need to have many children to work the fields and to have them live to adulthood, etc. So it is a symptom. High fertility rate is a symptom of powerlessness, and we have to address that root.
So I'm going to use myself as an example, and I'm hopefully won't appear too heartless, but I have access to good food, and hunger isn't something that I have to deal with. So how does the issue of world hunger impact me and others who aren't facing it on a daily basis?
Well, I would start with just the observation about human beings is that I think deep in our evolutionary wisdom, we know that basically we do sink or swim together, and that, yes, you may not be hungry. I'm certainly also not never had to experience that. And yet we ourselves are suffering from the same powerlessness in the structure of our economy and our government that poor people are in the global South. It's just a lot more severe for them. But in terms of the same challenge of really having a voice and having a say and how our resources are used in this country and protecting our natural resources, we also are in the same boat as many people living in the global South. And so, for example, just take water. In the world, something like 40% of all food produced depends on irrigation. And in our country, the biggest source is groundwater. One biggest source of groundwater is the Ogallala Aquifer, and we are draining that. We are draining that by this heavy industrialized system of farming that is so meat-centered. And so you and I may not be experiencing it, but our children will. What our grandchildren will, what will happen when that is gone?
You wrote a version of World Hunger 40 years ago, and of course it's evolved in the last 40 years. I'm curious, when you look ahead to the next 40 years, what does the book look like? Do you whittle it down to 8 myths instead of 10?
Well, it's not as if the myths reduced, actually. We decided to reorganize for the purposes of writing a more compact book. If anything, the myths seem to be growing and changing, certainly. You know what? I'm not very good at predicting the future because from an ecological point of view, you know, change is occurring. We're all interconnected moment to moment, and things can change extremely rapidly in a positive as well as a negative direction. And all the things that most inspire me that I write about in this book, I would never have predicted 40 years ago. So, you know, the stories I told you about Brazil and the right to food, the story I told about Niger or about Southern India, the state government actually be involved in offering stipends for village activists to teach ecological agriculture. I don't think I would have guessed that. So I really have a hard time predicting the future, but I do know that it all depends on one leverage point, in a sense of whether we recognize that we ordinary, quote-unquote, people do have power, that I like to say the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because within an ecological worldview, we're all connected. If we're all connected, everything we do sends out ripples. Even our decision not to act, that also has ripples. So I just think that it's not possible to know it's possible, and therefore it's really hard for me to predict. I hope that doesn't sound like a cop-out.
Oh, no, that's perfect. It would be suspect if you were to tell us exactly what it's going to look like in 40 years. When was the issue of hunger, when was it made personal for you?
Oh, wow. Okay, I am a child of the 60s. My first job was, in effect, given to me by Lyndon Johnson. I describe myself as a covert agent in the war on poverty. I was a community organizer hired as a housing inspector, but my real job was to go door-to-door for the welfare rights organization. And the women that I met as I went door-to-door were trying to survive on welfare, and they were constantly at the edge of not having enough to feed their children. It was up close. It was personal. The woman I worked most closely with, Lily, died of a heart attack at, 40, in the early 40s. And I knew that Lily died of stress, not from a heart attack. And so from that, it took me a couple years from that, her death, to figure out that I had to go basic. I had to dig to the roots of the problem. And I thought that food would be the way to go deep, that everybody was interested in food. And if we could just work out a system where we all had access to healthy food, that other problems would resolve as well, that food was the entry point. And that was the beginning of my adult life, and that was what led to Diet for a Small Planet. It was that youthful intuition that food was the key to unlock all the mysteries of economics and politics.
Frances, thank you so much for talking with me.
My great pleasure. It was really fun.
That was Frances Moore LePay talking about her new book, World Hunger, 10 Myths. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. Each month, we'll have a segment on The Food Show featuring Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising about growing a year-round garden. This month, we are closing in on getting plants in the ground. There are a lot of variables to consider before putting all your baby plants outside, which we'll be discussing with Marisha. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
So like I said, we're getting to that point of the year when it's nearly time to put plants in the ground. And a lot of seeds and starts are temperature dependent. So how do we know if it's safe to plant directly in the garden?
Well, I have a thermometer both in the soil and then also a thermometer that checks the air temperature, which provides guidance for what plants can go in the ground now.
And what vegetables should we be seeding directly in the ground, and what should we be starting indoors?
It's time to plant peas outside. You can also plant lettuce and chard and some of the root crops like parsnips and carrots and potatoes and beets. Those all can be direct sown outdoors. Radishes can go outdoors. I tend to start my brassica family indoors just so the slugs don't eat them, because those tender young plants are so tasty for slugs. So while they're being started indoors, it is fine to plant the broccolis, cauliflowers, cabbages outdoors now. I'm just waiting a little bit for mine to get bigger. And then indoors right now, you can start your tomatoes so that they're big and ready to go in by the time the air temperature hits 50 degrees or 60 degrees so that they can go outside. Generally, we don't put out the tomatoes or peppers or basil or eggplant until May, but now's a good time to start them indoors so they have a boost on the season.
So you talked about the slugs, and as we all know, it's been raining a bit lately. How dry does the soil need to be before we plant?
Well, I tell my students that you want to make a snowball with your soil. And if that snowball sticks together, then it's too wet for planting. If the snowball gets a little crumbly and falls apart, then your soil is ready for planting.
And what happens if we plant too early?
Well, some plants are prone to fungal disease, so they can rot in the soil if they don't have enough airflow or if the soil's too waterlogged.
So we're talking about planting directly into the ground and getting your starts ready, but we can also be doing some bed prep. What is the benefit of preparing the garden bed at least a week before planting into it?
At least a week is good for preparing your bed in advance. I tend to try to go for 2 or 3 weeks in advance, and that gives the soil microbes time to work in the nutrients in the soil to mix it in. I don't till much in my garden. I let the earthworms do the tilling and the beetles and all of those arthropods that work their way through the soil. So they get a head start on working in the nutrients. It is worth saying that having a good eye right now on adding lots of organic matter into the soil will really pay off. It can be said that you need to add about 3 to 4 inches of organic matter per year for your soil. And as we look towards the summer, if we have a drought like we did last year, all of that organic matter in our soil is going to pay off by increasing the nutrient holding capacity and the water holding capacity throughout the drought.
So you were talking about preparing the bed, and you said you don't till that much. What do you suggest for the best methods of prepping the bed?
Well, what we do is we mulch heavily in the winter so that the rain that falls over the winter doesn't compact our soil. We mulch with leaves that we gather locally. And once it's time for planting, we'll rake back the leaves, we'll add a top dressing of compost, and then sometimes we'll just put some burlap sacks on top so that it's shaded for the microbes to work in the compost. Sometimes we'll put our chickens on the bed so that they can work stuff in and scratch things up and add their fertility and eat any bugs that they might want to eat, or slugs especially, and get all that stuff mixed into the soil to prepare the bed for planting.
So each summer we run into the perennial problem of weeds. And so I was wondering if there's anything we can do at this time of year for weed control.
Absolutely. The best thing to do for weed control is to watch for when those plants are about to flower. Many weeds are really good for enhancing soil fertility in our soils. They have deep tap roots, and that's one reason why they're so tenacious. But once these weeds start to flower, then they're going to be reproducing in the in our garden. Especially right now, we've got snapweed that's starting to flower and go to seed, and those seeds just spread prolifically. So I try to let my weeds go until they are about to flower, and then I'll pull them. If I pull them too young, it takes a lot of effort to pull all the weeds, and they just keep coming back. So I'll let them grow big so they can have good interactions in the soil, and then once they're flowering, I'll pull them out.
It also seems like now is a good time of year because the soil is wetter. I know in the summertime it can be challenging to get the weeds out.
Yeah, the soil is nice and receptive right now due to the water.
So what can we do right now to care for perennials, such as fruit trees?
Well, for your fruit trees, we need to finish pruning, and it's basically the apples that I've seen in my yard that haven't started budding out or flowering. So with the others that are already flowering, it's important to protect the buds. And so if you need to get in there with even your berry bushes too, you want to make sure that you don't damage the buds, you don't break off any flowers, because those are going to be your fruit come summer. It's also a good time to put out some mason bee homes. Mason bees are a solitary bee that's responsible for most of the pollination for our fruiting crops, and they're active between March and June. So mason bee hives can be put in the under the eaves of your home or directly in your trees. And if you're planning on planting fruit trees or grafting to your fruit trees, now's a good time to do that. And that's also a good time to mention that the Home Orchard Society Scion Exchange is this Sunday on March 20th. And for anyone who's interested in getting scions to graft to their fruit trees, there's going to be an amazing display of just about every type of fruit you can imagine available for free, as well as rootstocks for sale or people that will graft fruit trees for you this Sunday. And that's in Canby.
Great. Do you have any workshops coming up? Any garden workshops?
Well, I've got my once a month workshop series on what to do now in the garden. The next one is on April 5th. That's at People's Food Co-op. It's on one Tuesday of every month. And this April 5th, we're going to be focusing on the brassica family and cover crops and soil fertility. I think I'm going to have a plant sale on March 27th where a lot of these early season plants are going to be available. There's going to be a food forest workshop in Forest Grove on April 9th. And then our online permaculture design course will start at the end of the month. And for this semester, we're offering an introduction to permaculture course online through Oregon State University. And that introduction to permaculture course is for free for anyone who wants to sign up.
Great. I think we have a lot of notes, a lot of work to do in the garden to get started. Marisha, thank you so much for coming back on the food show.
Thanks, Chris.
That was Marisha Auerbach talking about what you can be doing in your home garden this month. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. There's a business in Portland that is embracing its minority and woman-owned identity in an industry dominated by males. Started in 2013, Royalty Spirits, who make Myru Pear Vodka, entered the distillery scene with a dare-to-be-brave attitude. I recently talked with Chauncey King, the owner of Royalty Spirits, about her experience as a business owner. What does Myru mean?
So Myru means to see, and it's an old wise tale about a sea goddess who dominated souls with a potion. So for me, being a female entering to this male-dominant industry, I figured Myru would just pretty much describe itself. So I am going to dominate this male-driven industry.
So I want to talk a little bit about your backstory. What were you doing before starting Royalty Spirits?
Mm-hmm. So I've always worked in human resources. I've been a recruiter for over 16 years, but I was always a bartender by trade. So I've always been interested in just the mixology. How do you create your own spirit? Like, what's behind the scenes? How does this work? And I just started kind of like playing around with that idea, which led me to Royalty Spirits.
How do you take your human resources experience and just combine it with the sort of the bartending experience?
It's interesting that you say that because I had to bring out my whole, you know, recruiter experience when I'm looking for distributors. I went on LinkedIn and kind of did some passive recruiting. So what I did was just looked at different distributors, sales reps, and the different states and stuff. And I went in just kind of like sent them an intro email saying who I am and what I'm looking to do. And I've got like so many responses. So, you know, recruiting is about closing the deal, and it's kind of sales in a way. So I'm able to transfer those skills into my whole vodka in my selling and closing deals, and just been a people person. So it allowed me to be a people person and know how to talk to folks and, you know, just be interactive. And that's what you do when you're recruiting.
Well, it's one thing to play around with it, and then it's a totally another thing to launch a business. Mm-hmm. So what was that? How was the leap to starting the business?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and to be totally honest, I had experienced some adversity with, you know, a male, some domestic violence, and it was more like, I'm getting back at you. So I'm going to do something that all women should do. I'm going to terrorize these men. So I just, you know, like I said, I've always been interested, and it just made me even more driven to show that I can stand up, I can brush myself off, I can do this.
Well, that's amazing. I feel like mm-hmm. you have those experiences, and they can bring somebody down and affect somebody for years, but it seems like you took it and used it for the opposite.
Exactly. I just kind of, you know, threw myself in there and just got up and said, you know what, I'm not going to let this get me down. And so that's my whole dare to be brave. Like, get up, you know, continue your life, strive for the best. Don't let anyone or anything hold you down. Use it. Turn lemons into lemonade, right?
How are you able to find the support to start your business?
Support financially or support?
All kinds of support, yeah.
My family supports me a lot. And I've also recently won the PDX Startup Challenge. So I get a lot of support from PDC and also the individuals that provide in-kind services. And that's just been a great experience for me.
We've talked earlier, you're a mother, mm-hmm. And you just jumped into this. Mm-hmm. You know, at a certain point, some people would think, well, okay, I guess I'm going to settle, or like, this is my life, and this is how it's going to be. as opposed to saying, well, I'm going to grab this opportunity and go with it. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you didn't sort of, and settling I know is the wrong word, mm-hmm. like having a family is mm-hmm. is very
but
wonderful.
Just, yeah, you're just comfortable in your spot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm not. And I'm always changing. I'm always growing. And when I was totally self-employed, I said, okay. I was kind of worried for a minute. And then I was like, you know what? I can do this. Let's do it. And I'm so much at peace. I go to my kids' schools. You know, I go on field trips. I pop up. You sit in classrooms. You know, I'm at the games. And it's not a stressful morning. Everybody get up. Get your business handled. Let's get out the door. I'm not like it was when I was doing the whole 9-to-5. So it's an awesome experience. Yeah, and my kids love it. You know, because they see me working. I'm working at night. I'm working in the day. But we have more time for each other. And then speaking to that, my daughter, she has a lip gloss line and she's 4 years old. So, you know, I have my hands in like so many pots, and I also mentor other young females who want to be entrepreneurs. So I'm all over the place, and I absolutely love it because I'm all over the place doing something that I enjoy, and I'm on no one's clock.
Well, it sounds like you're using this opportunity and you're using what you've created with Royalty Spirits to empower other women. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about what you want to accomplish by having these distilling classes or mm-hmm. by bringing up women through the company, mm-hmm. Creating new women leaders and entrepreneurs?
So I want women to know that we can do just as much as our counterpart. I want women to believe in themselves. I want them to know that they're strong. I want them to know that even though you experience adversity, that doesn't have to be your life. Your past isn't your future. So it's up to you to change that, right? And it's up to you to make a difference within yourself and for your family. So with these classes, it's also going to be, you know, women empowerment teaching. But in the same time, you're learning your craft. This is what, you know, you want to do. So they'll have a trade, and also we will work on building them from the inside.
How long have you lived in Portland?
I've been back for 7 years now. I grew up here as a kid. I went to college at Cal State Hayward in Oakland, and I stayed there about 11 years. And so I've been back seven years now.
And it seems like, I mean, we know that Portland is changing rapidly, and I'm sure you've seen it having grown up here. Mm-hmm. And then also in the last 7 years, there's been a lot of changes. Mm-hmm. I've been here for 7 years as well. Well, okay. I didn't grow up here, though. Uh-huh. But yeah, it also seems like you're taking this opportunity to, it's like adapting to some of those changes. There's mm-hmm. this, you know, this growing distilling sort of industry that's mm-hmm. popping up in Portland,
right.
And it seems like you're adjusting to what is happening here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yes, and to be honest, as I've seen Portland change, I didn't know if I wanted to adjust. You know, first I was against it. Like, where's our neighborhood? Or where's, like, things have changed. Where's our businesses? Where's everything going? And I had to learn, you know, to grow. Wherever you are, you have to adapt, right? And you have to use those things to your advantage. So for me, with the distillery role, there's not one African-American distiller, right? So I'm more than happy to be that first African-American distillery in Portland and in the Northwest, period. So I'm excited. I take advantage of the opportunities. Like I said, I've met some really good people with the changes. And so it's working well for me.
And hopefully your story then can empower other people to do similar paths in
yes.
similar sort yes. of industries.
Yeah, and I wish that I had someone just kind of take me under their wings and say, okay, this is what you need to do. A lot of it's just Google. You know, that's what my first year was like. So now I have a story to tell. I have experience to share. So I would love to take a group of women and say, hey, this is my blueprint. You know, here it is, to see if you can tweak it to make it yours.
So you've described Royalty Spirits as the first minority-owned empire of its kind. Using the word empire, you clearly want to see big things from this business. Mm-hmm. What do you imagine is the future of Royalty Spirits?
Mm-hmm. So the future of Royalty Spirits, I'm actually going to be introducing another product, hopefully by the end of the summer. And then also I'm working on building a distillery here in Portland. to, and then that way I can in turn bottle product for other people. And then I also want to have an academy for women who are interested in the beverage, adult beverage industry. That's the ultimate goal. And then I'm done with it.
Then it is the empire.
It is the empire. Yes.
So you said you worked bartending. Did you know anything else about distilling or the sort of liquor production process before starting this business?
Not much. You know, I did a lot of research. Like, I researched for about 2 years. I met with different distillers, and I actually went to visit distilleries as well to kind of get a bigger picture on what goes on before the bottling process. But yeah, just research. And then I met with someone, and he kind of showed me the whole, you know, because mine's distilled from grain. So how do you get the corn? What happens next? The different pots and the filtration process. I'm like, wow, this is cool. And I'm no chemist, but, you know, it's exciting.
Who's the person who's going to most enjoy Myru vodka?
Mm-hmm. The person that's going to most enjoy Myru vodka is a female that is confident, that's strong. She's a fighter. She's bossy in all ways. Either she has her own business or she's successful, but she runs her show.
Chauncey, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Chauncey King, owner of Royalty Spirits and Myru Vodka. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. Regardless of what we as individuals choose to eat, meat impacts us one way or another. But where did that relationship begin? And how was our relationship with meat evolved over time? Marta Zaraska asks those questions and more in her new book, Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. I have Marta on the phone talking with me from France. Marta, welcome to The Food Show.
Hi, I'm glad to be there.
So you start the book pretty far back in the history of man. When did humans first start eating meat?
So just like I wrote in the title of my book, it has been about 2.5 million years now that we've been eating meat. It's quite hard for scientists to be very precise, but it's about 2.6, 2.5 million years. And also, it's important to remember that at the very, very beginning, we didn't exactly eat a lot of meat. So it just started, but it was very occasional. So basically when our ancestors would stumble upon a carcass left over by some other carnivores, they would scavenge the meat. But we've been only really true carnivores and eating, actually not carnivores, but omnivores, eating quite a lot of meat for about 2 million years when we've been having and adding meat to our diet on a constant and regular basis.
So you mentioned that human brains likely grew as a result of incorporating meat into our diets. What does that mean for our relationship with meat?
So yes, that's what scientists actually say. They actually even say, some of them, that meat made us human, because meat is a very calorie dense, nutritious food. And back then, 2.5 million years ago, 2 million years ago, you know, we didn't have the stores we have nowadays with plentiful, abundant, great foods, vegetarian foods, and all the other foods that we have nowadays. So meat was very special back then because it provided our ancestors with very this nutrition food that they needed to grow the brains, because brains are very energy guzzling in a way organs. They require a lot of good calories, so to provide for this organ, and meat was likely that food. And of course, it doesn't mean really much for us nowadays, other than we do have big brains, because nowadays we have a lot of different foods that we can choose from. We don't have to go for meat, and but definitely this feeling that meat is something very special and important for us became ingrained in our culture, and this actually still lives on.
I want to talk about the kind of the impact of our brains today and how we what our relationship with meat is like. Could you tell us a little bit about the idea of meat hunger?
Yes, so actually in several tribes across the planet, there is something that they call meat hunger. Many tribes, hunter-gatherer tribes, actually have special words to differentiate meat hunger from any other types of hunger. So, for example, vegans say, for some of them say that hunger for plant foods comes from a different part of the body than the hunger for meat. So, hunger for meat in one New Guinea tribe, they say it comes from the throat, for example. So they really have this special word. And most likely what it means that they are hungry for protein, because actually studies show that humans and many other animals crave protein. And if we don't have about 15% of it in our diet, we start as craving this meat hunger in a way. And because their diets are very often quite poor, they don't have many plant foods to choose from, then, and many of them in some regions of our planet can be poor in protein, then meat is the protein. But once again, this is not the case for Westerners, because we have plentiful beans, lentils, and so on that give us all the protein that we need, and we do not have to have a special hunger for meat, but we can still have hunger for protein.
Is there something about the way meat tastes that leads some individuals to wanting it?
Oh, yes, definitely. So I've managed to, by talking to the scientists and reading all the studies, to figure more or less what it's about. And it seems that the really important ingredient in meat is, first of all, it's fat. Second of all, it's the fifth taste called umami. This is this stands in Japanese for delicious. And the third thing is something called the flavors created in a reaction called the Maillard reaction. This is the browning that happens when you grill meat, for example. The outside becomes brown and crusty. So this is a reaction, a chemical reaction, that creates very smells that we really find delicious. This is the same thing that happens when you toast bread, for example. This is also the Maillard reaction. But this mixture of fat and the smells of the grilling, the Maillard reaction, and umami taste, which meat has plenty in it, just like, for example, mushrooms or cheese, which makes pizzas very delicious, is what creates a very unique package that really appeals to our taste buds.
And so eating meat can be like an addiction for people. Why is giving up meat harder for some than others?
So there are plenty of reasons for that. First of all, it's definitely harder for men than for women, because, you know, in our culture and history, we came to believe that meat is their true food for men. There are no reasons whatsoever to think that it should be this way, no biological reasons. This is all based in our culture because, you know, the men were the ones who hunted and they had the goods, so they, you know, they created this meat as something that was theirs. So definitely it's harder for men because, you know, real men eat meat kind of thing. This is the cultural stereotype that we have. But there are other reasons. For example, some people have are more what's called neophobic. This means that basically means that they are less likely to try new foods. And this is something that's partially genetic. So, for example, if your parents do not like to try any new food, they'll not go for sushi whatsoever or any ethnic cuisines, you are also less likely to change your what you eat. So, you know, vegetarian food is also a new food. So these kind of people are less likely to try different diets. So this is something that you may have in your genes that can make it harder to try something new. And there is also something that's about 3.5% of society is umami blind. It means that they cannot detect this delicious taste of umami. And if you cannot taste it, that quite likely, you know, meat doesn't have so much appeal to you. So that could make it easier to go vegetarian.
So I want to talk a little bit about the future of meat eating. It's shifting over time as some countries, including China, are incorporating more and more meat into their diet. What does the future of meat eating look like?
It depends how we go about it. So if we continue the way we are, it doesn't look very good, because basically we do not have enough earth for everybody to eat as much as Americans. It's just impossible, physically impossible. We'll need another planet for that. But if we do reduce our meat consumption significantly, and that is something we have to do if we, you know, care about our planet and the environment, you know, meat eating is responsible for as much greenhouse gas emissions as all the transportation combined. So all the cars, planes, trains, ships, everything you can imagine that's moving, you know, meat eating is equal to that. So we have to reduce, and we have more and more ideas how to do that. First of all, of course, there are the plant foods, but there are also more and more very fancy, you could say, fake meats that are starting to taste basically as like the real deal. Some people are proposing edible insects, others are trying to grow meat in labs. So, you know, so there are plenty of solutions that are out there that our scientists and researchers are trying to come up with to help us wean ourselves off meat.
Marta, we have about a minute left, but I want to know, for you personally, how did researching and writing this book affect how you look at food?
That's a good question. So I don't think it affected that much how I look at food, because I've been more or less a vegetarian before and I'm still more or less a vegetarian, but I think it made me look differently at other people and more. I became more tolerant to different ways of eating and a kind of more understanding how difficult it is to give up meat. I still believe that we should really reduce significantly, vastly, you know, a lot our meat consumption, but at the same time, I understand much better how very difficult it is and how many, you know, things are keeping us in the ways we are. So the culture, the society, the history, you know, the meat industry, the taste. There are so many reasons why it's not easy. So I became more understanding to people who find it very difficult to eat meat, and that's I think one thing that has changed.
Marta, thank you so much for talking with me on the Food Show.
Thank you for talking with me as well.
That was Marta Zaraska, author of the book Meat Hooked. And that's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Francis Moore-Lepe, Marisha Auerbach, Chauncey King, and Marta Zaraska for being on today's show. I also want to thank our excellent board operator, Kristen. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives, and don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of April for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, honey. You old gloomy sight. Good morning.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Lady Sings the Blues, showing Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. Diana Ross portrays jazz singer Billie Holiday in this biographical drama. The film depicts her early attempts at a singing career and her eventual rise to stardom, as well as her difficult relationships and drug addiction. Again, that's Lady Sings the Blues, Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the opening reception of Giving Back, The Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. This event was originally scheduled for Friday, January 13th. Giving Back illustrates Black philanthropic experiences and giving traditions grounded in faith, mutuality, responsibility, and social justice. Images and stories are from the book Giving Back, a tribute to generations of African-American philanthropists. Again, that's the opening reception of Giving Back, The Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's time for Jazz Lives, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting an evening with Spanish classical guitarist Pablo Sainz Villegas, Born and raised in La Rioja, Spain, Pablo Villegas performs compositions that echo his homeland's musical heritage. January 20th at the Newmark Theater in Portland. Tickets and information are available at portland5.com. Also, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Joe Barr and Rotisserie, now offering a Latin-inspired brunch every Sunday, featuring chilaquiles, mole, enchiladas, and more, all cooked in a wood-fired oven by Chef Elmer Santos. With a live Latin jazz band and changing drink menu, Joe Barr aims to add a little rhythm and flavor to Sunday brunch. Menu, calendar, and more at joebarrpdx.com. Well, as we slip and slide around here in the city, let's start off the show with, in fact, let's warm up a little bit here with a tune called Snow Samba.